Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labor MP Andrew Little.
This week, with Health and Treaty Negotiations Minister Andrew Little, I asked him about the government's overseas recruitment campaign for specialist nurses and a paper calling for the community isolation program to be revamped under the Omicron wave. But I began by asking Andrew Little what he thinks of the Green Party's proposal over the Waitangi weekend to revisit all past treaty settlements and return stolen land.
I don't know a lot of the detail of the policy, but look, we have about 87 settlements now done under the current framework over the last 30, 35 years. So kind of reopening those would be, I think, you know, problematic. I think you look at some of the bigger settlements, the Ngaitahus and the Waikato Tainus, even some of the more recent ones, the Manapouras and so on. Then reopening those would be, I think, a very challenging exercise. But I think the whole basis on which we've done treaty settlements, a fundamental principle has been that the Crown doesn't seek to expropriate private land. The only exception to that is where land used to be owned by a state-owned enterprise. So it used to be Crown land and is sold into private hands, and that is noted on the land title. Then that land can be the subject of a resumption application, they call it, in the Waitangi Tribunal. But by and large, when we look to return land, it is land that is owned by the Crown at the time that agreement is reached, or sufficient funding is provided to the iwi to purchase private land that is of significance to them and that they want. So, there is that. I get the point that the reality about the settlements that we have done is that they don't fully compensate for the losses that iwi suffered as a result of confiscation, as a result of dodgy land deals, as a result of all those sorts of things. But what we do seek to do in those settlements is to acknowledge the wrong done, provide some redress to allow the iwi to start to rebuild themselves economically and socially, and to give them the chance to place their voice in the power structures of the country so that they can get a say on policy and direction and restore their place as it ought to have been had the treaty been properly honoured from its outset.
And while we're on the subject of treaty settlements, have you had any progress on the Ngāpuhi treaty settlement?
Look, there's a lot of work going on within Taitokoro, with Ngāpuhi. A lot of the hapū are talking within each other and within hapū and between hapū. There are groupings being formed and coming together. There's a number of groupings now have come forward and said they wish to start the process of developing a mandate so they get representatives. The way it works is, a hapū or group of hapū, they develop a mandate. It's then up to the Crown to be sure that that mandate is truly representative, so the Crown then recognises the mandate, and that's the basis for the Crown to then negotiate. So there's a lot of dialogue going on, and I'm encouraged by what I'm hearing, but we're not in a position to negotiate with any group of hapū at the moment.
Okay, moving on to my second topic for now. It's about the government's campaign to recruit ICU nurses from overseas. Now, that campaign only started very recently, and considering more than 2 years in the pandemic, is it a little bit too late?
We heard a shortage of nurses for a long time, so this government provided additional funding to DHBs 2 years ago, in fact 3 years ago, for additional nurses, about 3,000 additional nurses across the network. We actually, a lot of those positions remain vacant because there is a worldwide shortage of nurses generally, as well as ICU nurses. When I got drawn into the various issues around our nursing workforce last year, there were three principal issues. One was we had to close out the negotiations for the collective agreement that had been dragging on for a long, long time. Secondly, we had to make progress on pay equity, which was another means by which nurses' pay would be boosted. We also had to review the safe staffing levels because that was a major bugbear for nurses. Many nurses repeatedly turning up and working on a shift that was short-staffed. So we've made progress in all those things. We've concluded the bargaining. The nurses got a pay increase towards the end of last year, put some back pay. We've now got agreement in principle on pay equity. That's got to go through a process, but that will significantly boost nurses' pay. And we've completed the review of the safe staffing agreement about nursing. We'll release that shortly. And that's got some recommendations about things we need to improve life for nurses. We need to do all those things before we did a recruitment campaign, because if we're going to recruit nurses into the New Zealand system, we've got to be able to say, this is the way things look, this is, you know, this is what the pay is, and this is the conditions you'll work in. So the timing is about right, given all the other things that we had to do to line up and have a recruitment campaign that's got the best chance of success.
But we have recently heard of all the working conditions that nurses have to go through in this country. Why do you think the conditions here will be appealing for overseas workers to come over here?
Well, we know that what the nurses and their advocates have been raising with us is obviously issues about pay, and then the issues about, you know, short-staffed shifts. Even though we have a safe staffing accord, and that safe staffing program has been around for the best part of 12 or 13 years, but it just had not achieved what it needed to achieve. So when we became government in the end of 2017, first thing, or early in 2018, we made a recommitment. We're going to see that through and have it properly implemented. And we got to the middle of last year, which was when the implementation was meant to be finished by. And it was, you know, one DHB, I think, had fully completed implementation. A whole bunch of others were close to completion, but still hadn't. And then there were some who were lagging well behind. We needed to fix that up. We still needed to fix that up. We got some recommendations to do that. So we've addressed nurse pay, we've addressed the working conditions. Now we've got a basis on which we can run a recruitment campaign that means that, you know, we can be very clear to nurses who are looking at the New Zealand system to say what exactly the environment is that they would be walking into.
How many people do you think can the health system recruit out of this campaign?
I'm not sure. I mean, you know, we've got at least 1,600 vacancies at the moment across the workforce. That's just in the DHB system. If you look at the aged residential care, we've got about 1,000 vacancies there. So, look, we need a lot of nurses, and so we're doing everything we can to do that.
And back in October, the end of October, the government has allocated several MIQ spots for overseas health workers for them to come into the country, 300 each month. How many have used those spaces so far?
So it started in November down to the end of January. I think around about 320, 330 places had been taken. All the places for February are booked. Most of the places for March are booked. And so those spaces are being taken up. I'm satisfied with the progress that's being made.
Are these mostly going to the public system or private healthcare?
Look, it's a combination of both. I don't know what the proportion will be. I think the majority will be in the public system, but I know because I've personally helped some private organisations to get their nurses that they're trying to recruit from overseas to get them spots as part of that MIQ allocation for health workers. So, look, it's a combination of both public and private.
Okay, moving on to my final topic for today, I want to talk about the the community isolation system under the Omicron wave. Now, a recent report by South Auckland GP Dr. Matri Harewood in the New Zealand Medical Journal said the home isolation system needs revamping under Omicron, particularly because during our initial Delta wave, the frontline health services were overwhelmed, and even though the government has said people who were isolating in the community will be monitored by Healthline, the paper said it didn't happen. So want to know what you think about that.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's entirely accurate. Certainly in the early stages of the Delta outbreak, when the numbers were growing and more people were being had to isolate at home and be cared for at home, there were some problems with once the person got a positive result, they had to be notified to the public health unit, and then their job was to make sure that the person was properly assessed and got the health care that they needed. There were some cases where there was delay or people fell through the cracks. We got those things fixed pretty quickly. And people have got the care they needed, including getting pulse oximeters and getting care packages and food and all the rest of it. That was for Delta. With Omicron, we know there's going to be, we expect there will be a bigger surge and bigger numbers, and we simply won't be able to, you know, to find alternative accommodation for people. Everybody will have to be cared for in their home. And it won't necessarily be a thing that it'll be easy for, like telehealth services, for example, to be across. We've worked very closely with primary care, with GPs and doctors and what have you. We did with Delta to get them on board, and we've worked very hard with them to make sure that they're available for Omicron. So a lot of the, you know, a lot of doctors and GP practices are saying, yes, they want to be part of it, and they will be part of it because it'll be their patients. The main thing is to make sure that the organisations that provide that support, particularly food and where physical visits are needed, can do that, is providing support for those organisations because they are absolutely crucial. And as the numbers grow for Omicron, even though a lot more people will have much more milder symptoms, there'll be those who are still sick enough and will need extra support. But of course, anybody infected with any variant of COVID, you know, shouldn't be going out and about. So people do need to stay home, and we need to make sure that they're properly cared for and got food and all the rest of it at home.
Why not transfer the responsibility entirely to primary healthcare providers?
Well, they're not. I mean, they have a big role to play, but if they're not doing the testing, then they're not getting the primary notification. And a lot of GP practices are not geared up to coordinate the kind of community care that is needed. So that's why the public system has got, you know, we set up a range of hubs where coordination of community support can be arranged alongside primary care. So that if you return a positive test, your GP gets notified. Your GP's job is to make sure that you're getting daily calls and daily checks and those sorts of things. But if you need extra help, or if anybody in your household needs extra help, or you need to get the shopping done or get your pet sorted out or get something done, the GP's not going to do that. So we need community care organisations who are doing that. They are going to play the critical role. So it's actually integrating them into the system that we've got. And in many respects, giving them the lead. You know, I look at organisations like South Seas and the Whunua in Auckland, in West and South Auckland. They play a lead role, including, in many cases, providing the clinical support too, but to provide care for families who need that extra support. They are the linchpin in this.
That was Labor MP Andrew Little. The Wire.